great country Q94. It's Coffee with Kyle, the extended version, as we talk more in depth on different subjects, maybe a little heavier subjects.
Yeah.
Not exactly fun for a Saturday morning radio show. And this way I can ask you far more in-depth questions.
Yep.
First things first, let's talk about the Uvalde shooting.
Sure.
And we had talked during an extended version, and you kind of went over the difference between an active shooter threat and then the difference between, okay, there's a threat, but the shooting has stopped.
Yes, yep.
And maybe that's why the response time was so long.
Yeah.
And when you walked out of there that day, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I understand it. I'm sure that's what happened.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's no, you know, it looks bad, but I'm sure there's a good explanation for
right.
it. And then they released the surveillance video of inside of the school, and you're like, I mean, I was watching it going,
this doesn't seem right.
I mean, I only did 10 weeks of the Citizens Academy and you know, just a few hours on investigations and whatnot. But I'm like, that 3 hours, I think we learned this isn't what you do.
Yeah, it was difficult to watch. You know, as you said, we talked about this earlier, and I said, well, let's hold judgment. We only have about 10% of the information at that point in time, and more information has continuously come out. And here's the thing that I've noticed with this in particular is the speed at which they're investigating this case is tremendous.
You know,
normally, you know, I can remember the Newtown shooting in Connecticut. We got that debrief, I want to say it was a year plus after that incident, where they actually released all the details and you could get a bigger picture of what was going on. And the you know, state legislature in Texas hasn't taken that path. They're doing this
very it's happening in real time.
Yeah, they're doing it fast. So then they release this video, and I sent it out to my staff, and just, you know, we talked about it at shift changes, and that was a difficult video to watch because the assumption that this was, you know, that he somehow had barricaded himself in a room, and that, you know, it had changed from, there wasn't really any type of rescue that could be done.
No,
it was clear that he was continuously shooting, and they were there within a few seconds.
Yeah, I mean, at first I was like, wow, their response time is very fast. It was like they were almost there before he had even taken a shot inside the building.
Yeah, well, they definitely were. Well, if you remember, the video shows him crashing his vehicle.
Yeah.
And those folks from the funeral home walk out to see if he's okay and lend assistance if they can, and he shoots at them. And then an officer arrives on scene, and an officer calls on the radio and says that they have them, they have the shooter in his sights, and asks, this is mind-blowing to me, he asks for permission to shoot him. And I guess that's a point that I drove home with my staff. Like, if you are justified in using deadly force, you do not have to call a supervisor to approve that use of deadly force.
Because at this point, you've already seen him be reckless.
Yeah, we look for a weapon, we look for intent, and we look for delivery system.
Yes.
And those three things were clearly there and justified the use.
And, I mean, going back to that, he shot at the people at the funeral home. So if he'd have just taken that, you know, shot there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough. And then he you know, was concerned about innocent bystanders and the bullet traveling someplace he didn't intend it to. And
which I also understand.
Right. But we also have an exemption in our laws that protect us from that liability, meaning it's a greater danger exemption, which means that not taking that shot creates a larger danger than
much
if you
larger.
Would take that shot and try to eliminate that threat early on in the case. And then, you know, when they have, I think it was like three officers responded in a group, and one of them went down the hallway and two of them kind of held back. There was one officer that repeatedly went down the hallway to try to engage with the shooter, and nobody went with him. And that was, for me, I'm like, where is his support?
Yeah.
This one guy, I don't know who he is. Probably never meet him. Maybe I will. He clearly wanted to go down and engage the bad guy, and just didn't have the support behind him. And
no.
So confusing to me.
It was very confusing, and I think I said this off air when I was watching it. It was almost like it was a group of guys, and they were waiting for somebody to tell them what to do.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, I understand, you know, there's protocols that you have, and there's, you know, drills that you do, and you wait for your, you know, lead officer or whatnot. And I get that they were from all different agencies.
Yeah.
However, I think we've all said, and we've talked about this, that in the heat of the moment or in a situation, you have to rise up. Somebody has to take charge.
Yeah, and you know what? This is kind of a deep conversation here, but I really think, and I don't know Uvalde, Texas in any way, shape, or form, but just from an outside looking in and knowing about policing, I really think that this speaks to the culture of that department, meaning has the power to make that decision been controlled by somebody in a legitimate authority position? Meaning, are the officers in Uvalde, are they able to make those decisions and be supported by their administration when they make those decisions? Or has that ability to make that decision been withheld from the line police officer and held onto by legitimate authorities, meaning the chief, a captain, a lieutenant, sergeant, whatever it is? And if that's the case, for me, that's disappointing, because I entrust my cops with handcuffs and with guns and with, you know, tools that can take somebody's Fourth Amendment rights from them by arresting them. Can, you know, use deadly force, can tase people, and they're empowered to make those decisions without my approval, without my first line supervisor's approvals, and knowing that if they do the right thing at the right time for the right reasons, they're going to have support behind them. And so I don't know, again, I don't know that police department all that well, but it really is concerning to me as far as the culture there and why they hesitated to make those decisions. You know, have they been disciplined in the past for making decisions when it should have been, or in their mind, it should have been held at a legitimate authority level and a first line supervisor or chief level? If that's the case, you know, that's something that really needs to be fixed, because you can't have, if I'm a police officer and I'm not given the power to make a decision on whether to cite somebody or arrest somebody, that is ingrained in me through the course of my career. And so when I get into the predicament of now I have an active shooter, well, wait a second, I need to wait for somebody to give me the permission.
Mm-hmm.
It just can't happen. That is not safe for your community. It is not healthy for your department. And I hope that some changes come of this, if that is the case. Hopefully that they learn some lessons there.
Well, that would go back to, you know, the officer that saw the shooter outside of the building asking for permission.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if the police department is ruled by fear, too, you know, or fear of reprimand for anything that you've done, or, you know, maybe they have a, you know, you don't shoot until, you know, don't engage.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that. I can't imagine working in that environment. I can't imagine chiefing a department where...
In that manner.
Yeah, where I just, man, that's
because
scary.
As a police chief, I mean, obviously you never want something of this caliber to happen in your community, but as a police chief, I feel like when the video would come out, you would be like, look, my guys did what they were trained to do.
Yep.
You know, I can't imagine being a supervisor, seeing that video and going, what are my officers doing?
Well, I will speak just about my department. I hope that I never have the responsibility of standing at a podium and answering those questions. But as I sit here on a Saturday morning recording this, I know that I have staff that can make those decisions and have made similar decisions, maybe not to that extent, but decisions that they then wait for me to review on Monday and say, yeah, you did exactly what you should have done. That's great. You know, great decision making. And so I have very little concern over, you know, my staff's ability and furthermore their empowerment to make those decisions. We give them a lot of tools. I don't put a rifle in their squad car or a ballistic shield in their squad car or a less lethal beanbag gun in their squad car and then say, before you ever get this out, you better approve it through me. That's insanity to me.
Well, right?
I mean, if you're putting them in their cars, you better be empowering them with the training and the ability and the knowledge to know when to deploy those things and use those things to save 19 lives.
Yeah. And I mean, like, there are a number of different agencies that did respond to that, which I think actually it makes it worse then that it was.
Well, I don't know, we don't know all the details, but I hope there wasn't a power struggle. I hope that somebody doesn't look like this happened, but I hope somebody stood up and took command of that scene and started making the difficult decisions. You know, there's a great quote that I talk about, and a great leader isn't somebody that makes poor decisions. A great leader is somebody that can make decisions. I'll go back. A poor leader isn't a leader that doesn't make good decisions. A poor leader is a leader that can't make decisions.
Exactly.
And so it's almost like this is one of those scenarios where you had somebody that maybe was a marginal leader and couldn't make a decision and didn't want to be held to that responsibility of making that decision. And unfortunately, nobody else stepped up to say, this is what has to happen. And at least for an hour, nobody did.
And I think this tape or video, whatever, can be used by a lot of police departments to maybe be an eye-opening experience. Like, okay, are my officers really prepared? Like, I think they are, but what can I do so that this never happens to me? I don't ever have to stand at the podium and answer these questions.
Well, first and foremost, we'll talk about just real quickly defunding the police, and this is a real life scenario here. So I met with Max Erickson, who's our firearms instructor, and he talked about how many rounds are we putting through our rifles at a distance. That first officer that had the suspect in his sights was at about 100 yards. And so was there a doubt in that officer's mind that he could hit what he was shooting at? And so my conversation with Officer Erickson was, we need to remove all doubt. We need to get on the range, and we need our officers to put more rounds through their rifles and remove all doubt of where that bullet's going to go and their ability to engage a target at a distance. And so let's go back to defunding the police now. Each one of those bullets costs us money.
Mm-hmm.
And so do we defund policing at this point in time and say, you know what, you're only going to shoot 10 rounds a year. We think that's sufficient because that's all we're going to fund. Well, then you face the consequences when you have an officer that pulls out a rifle
and
has that doubt of whether I can hit this target or not. And so I'm not saying we need to go out and spend thousands of rounds of ammunition, but we need to shoot enough times where the officer has the confidence when they take that rifle out of the rack in the squad car, they're going to be able to deploy that and shoot it accurately and eliminate a threat of somebody who is intent on killing 19 kids.
And you, as an officer, feel comfortable with your weapon. Yes. I mean, we've talked a lot about firearm safety.
That's the real-world application of funding police.
Yes, and why do they need this much ammo? Yep. Why do police departments need all of these trainings? Well, you know what? All of these trainings then hopefully get you prepared for the moment that situation happens.
Well, we mentioned in Citizens Academy that in the state of Wisconsin, officers have to fire 38 rounds a year. We have to qualify with our handguns and shoot 38 rounds through our handguns. That's a minimum requirement for the state of Wisconsin. Used to be 44. Because of budgeting issues, they dropped it to 38. So that's the minimum rounds we have to shoot. If society believes that that is sufficient to make us proficient in shooting our firearms, they're mistaken. It just isn't. It just isn't enough.
That's not at all.
And unfortunately, there are agencies that are strapped for cash, and you have to put shooting more than 38 rounds on a scale with paying for gasoline. And we need to respond for calls for service. We very rarely use our firearms, and so they cut a firearms budget, and so they can fund gasoline for their squad cars. So, you know, the departments that have had their budgets cut, thankfully we aren't one of those. They're going to see some real life impacts. And unfortunately, it may be the difference between them having the confidence in engaging a threat and not.
Which is sad.
Yeah, it is.
Moving on. Of course, I don't know why we started down this road because now they keep happening.
Yeah.
But there was another shooting in Indiana.
Yes.
At a mall.
Mall, yeah, food court in a mall.
Ended differently.
Yeah, so
not because of a policeman.
Yeah, no, and that's the reality is most of these shootings are not going to end at the hands of the police. It's just that's just how they typically end is either by suicide by the perpetrator or, you know, citizen. So in this instance, it was a a citizen who was carrying concealed and in the mall and engaged that mass shooter in 15 seconds and killed him. You know, the perpetrator shot, I want to say, if I read it right, if I remember right, 34, 35 rounds in 15 mm-hmm. seconds.
Yeah.
And the citizen shot shot 10 rounds and hit the suspect 8 times, which is incredible.
I was going to say, that's some impressive.
That is
yeah.
really good. Yep.
Yeah. And it...
It speaks to being prepared.
It is. It's yeah. definitely being prepared. And you can debate this all you yeah, want. Yeah. But it's a scary world that we live in which we're like, oh, well, at least a good guy with a gun took down a bad guy with a gun. Like, thankfully that good guy was there and, you know, they didn't have to wait for the police to come in and whatnot. But we've talked about this before, but... How did we get here?
Well, I'll tell you this, Lori.
How did
nobody
we get
listening to this, and I don't think you or I want to be here. I
mean, no.
We don't want to be in this predicament.
No.
However, I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, there is also a reality. And the reality is, for whatever reason, mental health or guns or media or, you know, gaming, who knows? Who knows what the cause for all of this is? Somebody paid far more than I will figure it out someday. But the reality is we're there. And so you need to take the steps as an individual to make sure you're prepared. And whether that's carrying a gun or whether that's carrying a first aid kit or a trauma kit to make sure that you can take care of people who are injured. Those are steps that we need to start taking as a society to say, okay, this is the reality. None of us like it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, nobody is enjoying this.
We can ban guns tomorrow.
And
it won't
drugs
stop.
Drugs are banned.
It won't stop.
Drugs
yeah,
are illegal.
Yeah. And
do you still have drugs?
We still do. We still fight that
Speeding
every day.
Speeding is illegal.
Yeah. It's just, we could pass that legislation tomorrow, and unfortunately, this is not going to go away. And so...
I've always always used the line of bad people are going to do bad things.
Yeah.
And that's, bad people will always find a way to do bad things.
One way or another. Yep.
One way or another. Yep. If somebody is motivated... They are going to find a way to carry out whatever, you think about it in so many ways, you know, oh, I'm really motivated. I want to, you know, run a 10K. Well, I'm going to figure out how I can run a 10K. I'm really motivated. Yep. Our motivation as humans works the same way with bad things.
Yeah. Yeah. When we get our minds set on things and you have that drive and obsession, and that's really what it is. Many of these active threat perpetrators are obsessed with
whatever.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know. I just said, I don't know how we got here. And the last time we did an extended version, we kind of talked about if you see something, say something.
Well, the reality is, and if you go back to Uvalde, there were people that he messaged in advance of this. You know, that mm-hmm. he was having these thoughts. People knew him. You know, it wasn't a surprise to them. It's the same with the gentleman in Illinois that we talked about on one of our episodes. People were aware of him and his intentions and that he had purchased firearms and, never said anything. And that communication piece is huge.
It is.
It is huge.
And I mean, even we talked about this, like I said last week, that you get calls for threat assessment and, you know, going through that process, and it might seem tedious. And as somebody who, you know, okay, they seem a little off, but well, I don't want to bother the police.
Bother us, please.
It could have been prevented.
Yeah.
And whatever steps that need to be taken, is it a mental health crisis? Is it just the person is lonely? The person got dumped, somebody didn't want to go out. Prom with them. Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous.
The triggers.
Yeah. The triggers, but nobody knows what that trigger is.
Right.
It is
very fascinating, and a lot of this stuff is open search. You know, you could Google this stuff, but it's very fascinating to read the debriefs of past active threat scenarios and shooters and perpetrators and their writings and their research and what they tell people versus what reality is. One of the things that is very common is they have a trigger in their life that turns their tables. And mm-hmm. whether it's a death in the family or a death of a pet or moving from a location to another location, something that they feel is very traumatic to them that sets them down this path. And they get an obsession with these events, and they start doing research. They start Googling these things. They start trying to figure out, you know, how abnormal are my thoughts? Mm-hmm. And then they start taking some actions. They acquire firearms, or they, you know, steal firearms from family members, or they try to gain access to safes that are around the house with firearms in them. And then typically it's another trigger. It's another event that puts them over the edge, whether it's a bullying event in school, whether it's a death of another family member.
It can be even a social media post that, something that very them. Simple yeah. that, you know, nobody even thinks is the trigger. You yeah. know, I not to equate this with suicide, but you know, if somebody is chronically depressed,
sure.
It might not be the big thing of yeah. oh, I lost my job or whatever. It's the
culmination of a lot of
it's
things.
It's a culmination yeah. of a whole bunch of very, very small things that just causes somebody to lose yeah. it. So again, with, you know, threats, it's a whole bunch of little things that just
yeah, we dismiss oftentimes
yes.
from the outside. We dismiss those yes. things, but they're very important to that person, and we have to. It's about communication. It's about making that connection and asking the difficult questions to that person, and trying to get to the root of what's going on, and then again, reaching out for help when you need help. You know, there's having a mental health crisis is not against the law.
No.
You know, we want to help
and there's
people.
Help.
Yeah, we want to help people. You know, you may be placed in handcuffs because you're riding in our car to a medical facility, but you're not under arrest. We're
no.
doing that because we have policies and stuff in place, but it's not against the law. So,
no.
you know, reach out, seek those opportunities for help. And I know the police department has a lot of connections in the community as far as mental health services and those types of things go. That we want to connect people with,
and I want to talk about something because the new mental health hotline,
yeah,
988, yep. Is now, I believe it's now,
yep, exactly.
It's fully operational. Yep. So I want to talk a little bit about this because 911 is very ingrained in our mind,
right? Right.
And I mean, we see story after story about, you know, some of them are funny, some of them, I mean, they're not funny because it's illegal, but how, I know you guys probably get a lot of 911 calls that are mental health crisis.
Sure, yeah.
How key is having now a dedicated line for that, and where does it go? I mean, we know where the 911 calls go. Where does the 988?
So they have regional call centers around the country. I believe, don't quote me on this, I think it was just over 100 regional centers that are taking these calls and fielding these calls. So this has been in the process and been in the works mm-hmm. for a number of years. I would imagine, I don't know this for certain, but I would imagine that there's very there's companies that specialize in this. We use what's called Northwest Connections. It's based out of Eau Claire. And that's an 800 number that we use here. But I could see them as being a 988 center as well mm-hmm. that would field those calls. So it is important in the context of there are many mental health crises that we respond to where the person is simply lonely and needs somebody to talk to and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And 988 really provides that service through a phone mm-hmm. you know, aspect. But they also have connections with emergency services in that jurisdiction as well that can then connect that individual with emergency services if it comes to that point. If they really need you know, a mental health evaluation, you know, that train or that tree of calls then ends up at our office or the sheriff's department's office, and we respond to those addresses in you know, for somebody who's in need of it. So it's just it's a way to bypass the localness of it and free up that 911 system to a 988 system that you know, people are just looking for some help. So reach out. And again, maybe sometimes it's just somebody to listen.
Yeah. You're just having a bad day.
Yeah.
Just another thing I want to touch base on, we kind of talked about this, but and we've talked a lot about community policing as sure. well. And I know, not a fan of scanner pages. I saw it shared on Facebook.
Okay.
And it was small city, very small city, officer responding to the caller can't get their TV to work.
Okay.
It doesn't give any more information about the caller. I saw it get shared on social media, so I clicked on it. Now, my mind, because of this show and doing the Citizens Academy, my mind was, clearly there was nothing happening in the city that the officer was free that he could go respond to this. But this is a low-risk, high-reward situation.
Yes, definitely.
Now, you don't know that going in because, there's crazy scenarios that it could be. But if it really is somebody that just can't get their TV figured out, that officer can go in. And I'm not saying your officers are TV techs or anything, but if it's somebody in a mental health crisis or just an elderly person who can't figure it out, that's a high reward for the officer to go, oh, hey, you have it on the wrong input.
So I'm super happy you brought this up because it strikes a chord with me. We do lockouts for apartment buildings in town.
Okay.
So apartment owners give us keys to their building, mm-hmm. and their tenants, when they lock themselves out, call the police department.
Okay.
And we go unlock the doors.
Okay.
Throughout my time as chief and as a police officer, there have been police officers that have said, "What a complete waste of our time. Why are we unlocking these doors?" and I'm very short to correct them, to say this is a huge opportunity for us.
It is.
Because Mrs. Smith, who locked herself out, will probably never have an interaction with law enforcement beyond us opening her door. And that is a great opportunity to make a connection with Mrs. Smith, introduce yourself, see how her day is going, and do a service of unlocking her door. The police department in Puerto Sheen has the highest budget of our municipality. We cost the taxpayers of Puerto Sheen the most, mm-hmm. between the water department, street department, sewer department, whatever. We are the 24-hour service in Puerto Sheen.
Yeah.
And so we are, when everything else fails, when they have no one else to turn to, they call the police department. And that's exactly how it should be.
Yeah.
And so I firmly believe that. And so you're right. You hit the nail on the head. I can think of a couple officers that have complained the most, and they're not cops anymore, or they don't work here anymore, and that's okay. We all have to have those changes. But if you don't recognize that as a police officer, to say this is not an inconvenience, this is an opportunity for me, then I need to retrain you. I need to retrain your brain because that's important to me. So, yeah, I like that train of thought. We have a small opportunity to influence somebody and maybe brighten their day a little bit.
Well, and actually, of course, everybody then goes to the comment section.
Oh, you're still talking about scanner pages?
It was a Friday night. I'm sitting on my couch, and I'm like, look at this. And I forgot to bring it up last week. Yeah. But I was actually, the comment section didn't make me mad.
No?
Because it was very much of, hey, okay, if it's so bad that the only person you can call is 911, like, clearly there's something bigger going on here. And obviously the officer is not busy.
Right.
Because you're not dropping a, more important crime to be like, oh, never mind. I don't need to do this. I don't need to do this DUI arrest or, I got to go fix somebody's TV. Like, okay, so you're driving around town patrolling. You can make a stop.
Yes. Just a super kind of humorous personal story. I was dispatched to a house one time where the lady reported that her furnace wouldn't work. And it was in the middle of winter. And I walked into her house. And I'm not lying, Lori. It was 90 degrees in her house in the middle of winter. And I knew right away that her furnace was just fine.
Yeah.
And when I arrived there, she told me that somebody had actually broke into her house and stole her furnace. And I needed to go downstairs and check that the furnace was still there. And when I got to the top of the stairs, there were spider webs all across the stairwell. Like, nobody had walked down these stairs for a number of years. And
it's 90 degrees in the house, so you know.
I made my way through those spider webs and lit up that furnace with my flashlight and said, there's your furnace, it's good. Obviously some more things going on in that house, but again, she was like, I think my furnace was stolen. I think my house is too cold. I think my furnace might be broken. I'm going to call the police department. Same thing. I had a lady 100 and some degrees out. We had heat indexes really high. She called because her air conditioner went out. I was able to connect her with Hermsons in Bloomington because they were open. And connect her with services that came and replaced her air conditioner or window air conditioner and helped her through that heat wave. Again, it was a weekend, and she was like, I don't know who else to call, so she called the police department. And that's exactly what a small-town police department is for.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because like you said, that person may not ever have an interaction again with the police, but that was a positive one. Nice. And they're a taxpayer, too.
Yep.
In that moment, that was what was most important to them.
And our dispatchers are very good about saying, my officers are tied up. Our officers are tied up right now. It's going to be a little bit, but we'll get to you. And so we do have to prioritize that. If we are on a higher priority call, we handle it and we move on. I have our statistics, you know, per calls per shift, mm-hmm. per calls per officer, per citation per officer, mm-hmm. per citation per shift. I have all those stats. We have time to unlock a door. We do.
Yeah.
We do.
Well, very enlightening discussion today.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
I feel like we covered a lot in there.
Yeah, it's good.
We got a lot covered. So it's the extended version of Coffee with Kyle from Dunkin' Donuts in Prairie du Chien.